back. This is Mark Dantas, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Mark Weber, the Executive Director of the Institute for Historical Review. Mark, how are you, sir?
Very good. Thank you, Mark, for having me on your show. I've admired your writing and your analysis for some years now. Your writings have appeared in a lot of different places over the last several years, and it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thank you. You know, my writing has suffered somewhat since I've been involved in radio again because I haven't had as much time to devote to writing as I once did, but I have a book review of Dilip Hero's The Iranian Labyrinth, which is probably going to be coming out in the next few days, and he hopefully will be a guest on this show after the new year. But, Mark, in terms of your own career and your own perspective on things, I wanted to start this conversation by having you interact with a statement made today by Paul Craig Roberts in his post with LouRockwell.com. The title of that post is "The Disrespect for Truth Has Brought a New Dark Age." And Paul Craig Roberts concludes his article by saying, quote, "When the Clinton administration allowed the media concentration in the 1990s, the independence of the American media was destroyed. Today there are a few large conglomerates whose values depend on broadcast licenses from the government. The conglomerates are run by corporate executives who are not journalists and whose eyes are on advertising revenues. They publish and broadcast what is safe. These conglomerates will take no risks in behalf of free speech or truth. The challenges that America faces are not terrorism and oil supply. The challenges that we face are the police state that George Bush has created, and the disrespect for truth that is endemic in government, the universities, and the media. The U.S. has entered a dark age of dogmas and unaccountable power." How does that relate to what you're doing at the Institute for Historical Review?
Well, Paul Craig Roberts is right on target. He's one of the best of the voices, dissident voices, that there are in this country, who speaks with some authority because he was a former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury or Undersecretary of Treasury some years ago, and his writings have been consistently hard-hitting and very much on the mark. We've posted quite a few of the essays by Paul Craig Roberts on our own website and distributed them through our IHR News and Comment service, which we through which we regularly distribute items by Paul Craig Roberts and others, too, which shed light on the events today. But there's no question of the failure of our media, especially in the last several years, to bring facts to the American public that they need to know. And this is, I think, was manifest most obviously in the run-up to the Iraq War, when a great deal of disinformation put out by the White House and by those who wanted war with Iraq was transmitted by the American media without commentary, without showing how false it was, and contributing greatly to the psychosis for the war in Iraq, which I think everyone now acknowledges has been a catastrophe for America and for the world. But this is part of a larger problem, and that is even in our Congress, the so-called opposition just doesn't really exist. With the exception of just one or two persons in the Congress, Ron Paul of Texas comes to mind, to a certain extent Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, the U.S. Congress has just failed utterly in its job to act on behalf of the American public and to speak up about these great issues of war and peace. Anyway, Paul Craig Roberts has identified in this essay one of the greatest problems of all, the consolidation of the American media, its subordination to corporate interests, and the failure of the media in America to act on behalf of the best interests of our people and of the world.
What do you think is ultimately behind this? Would it be a fair thing to say that the Israeli lobby has been the major player in this whole business of the consolidation and distortion of news, or just one of the major players?
Well, I would say this. The major factor has been economic. That is just the consolidation of media and the subordination of news interests and information to corporate interests. But along with that, in our society, any voices which are which any, in any forthright way, point out and deal with the power of the Israel lobby and of the tremendous grip that the Jewish Zionist power in this country has on our media is just not permitted. That is, the corporate interests just simply are quiet about it. They just don't. They just go along with the whole thing. We live in a society that insists upon, in our media and in our government and in our cultural life, a view which is consistent with, a subordinate to, Jewish Zionist power in our society. Now, corporate interests, and that is the major corporations, they're not. They're interested just simply in making money. But beyond that, there is a tremendous role of those who put the interest of Israel and put Zionist interests above those of everyone else in our national media, represented especially by organizations like the New York, the newspapers like the New York Times, and so forth. That's why an alternative media is so important. That's why programs like this one are very important, and one of the reasons why the Internet is so important, because fortunately there is a kind of an alternative media that has developed through the Internet and through programs like this one over the last 10, 15 years, although it's certainly a very subordinate one. I think a larger problem is that people around the country see, with each passing day, a larger and larger chasm, a disconnect between what we're told by our politicians, what we're told by our media on the one hand, and what people observe in their daily lives on the other. And what that leads to, ultimately, even with the control of the media, is a kind of skepticism, a kind of cynicism among across the public toward the media and toward politicians in general. I don't think ever before in American history has the newspapers and television and the political establishment been held in such disregard, such contempt by the public as they are today. And the media has contributed greatly to that. And that's a very dangerous thing.
Well, you know, one night, as an example of this, I think I've mentioned this before on this show, after the Iraq Study Group report came out publicly, I happened to be flipping through channels that evening and stumbled upon ABC's Nightline just before going to bed, and Terry Moran was on there giving his spin on the Iraq Study Group and interviewing a number of people that were connected with that project. And at one point, Lawrence Eagleburger, obviously very much an establishment political figure in the Eastern establishment in this country, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, probably the Trilateral Commission, major connections to Henry Kissinger and to others. Nonetheless, I think was speaking with some great insight on that show when he was discussing the same thing you're talking about, Mark, and that is that there is a crisis of confidence in our leadership and in our institutions today that's virtually unparalleled in our history. Do you think that in some measure that may end up being a positive thing, in that there may be finally something of a mass revolt in this country against the economic and political direction that we've been going in and the direction that our empire-driven foreign policy has been going in?
You're putting your finger on a very, very important issue, and that is this. Yeah, how things have to get worse before they get better. That is, there has to be a greater awareness of just how bad the situation is before we can do anything really to deal with it. But, of course, that means things are going to be bad. But the vast majority of people are not really very concerned about these larger issues. In every society, the great majority of people are first and foremost concerned about their day-to-day lives, their families, their economic welfare, and they don't really give much thought to these larger issues, economic, cultural, political, and certainly in foreign affairs, so that only a small minority of people in every society throughout history have ever had the interest and certainly the commitment to be concerned about these larger issues. That means that until the economic situation gets worse, most people aren't going to really care very much. And that's just the unfortunate reality, because the vast majority of people are content as long as they have television, as long as they have their paychecks, and as long as they're living, even if it's on credit cards, they're not going to be concerned. But there is, yes, I mean, there is unquestionably a great breakdown of confidence in our political institutions. I mean, one of the most obvious things is that as our political leaders keep telling us that America's greatest days are ahead and everything's going to get better, people can see around them that the country is becoming more and more a third world country with all that that implies. A great deal. I mean, anyone who's over the age of 40 or 50 in his own life can see the transformation in our society over the last 40, 50 years. And these trends are not good. If you project the trends of the last 40 years into the next 40 years or 50 years, it's a very ominous thing. And everyone can see that. And that's why there's it's one of the reasons why there's just a great fall in trust in our institutions and so forth. But until and unless things really economically get worse, the vast majority of people aren't going to do much about it. But there's a larger problem, I think, Mark, and that is this. Our political institutions, our way, our constitution, our flag, has been in place for an awful long time, and it's very difficult for Americans to conceive of any really fundamental change in our way of life or our political form of society.
We will be back with Mark Weber, the Executive Director of the Institute for Historical Review, and Mark Dankos America returns live from San Antonio, Texas on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Stay tuned. America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Mark Weber, the Executive Director of the Institute for Historical Review. Mark, one more question before I move on to the issue of the Sundell and David Irving situations and what you believe the implications of those particular circumstances are for free speech in the Western world. As far as this crisis of confidence in political leadership in this country, I wanted to mention what I think is a possible dreadful scenario that could take place in the next couple of years and then see what you think of it. I've been watching these events leading up to what seems to be an expansion of this war into Iran and all of the patterns that you cited at the beginning of the show that led up to the war with Iraq seem to be occurring again. Now, if we find ourselves getting into a preemptive war with Iran, with results as bad or worse than what we've already had in this war with Iraq, and you have a situation where there is some sort of a return to a general military conscription in the United States, and where the economic disaster of an expansion of this war would result in the dumping of American debt instruments on the open markets by Asian banks in particular, and you ended up with a situation where there was a much wider impact being visited upon the American middle class, or what remains of it, as a result of this war on terror and this expansion of this imperial war in the Middle East. Do you think it would be at that point, as more people's livelihoods were affected by these expansionistic policies, and as we could conceivably see a return to a military draft and more young American men and women being killed, that might be the catalyst for the kind of revolt against the institutional powers that be in our political and cultural and media realms that some of us have anticipated for years?
Well, that's a long question, Mark, and it's difficult to answer quickly. But yeah, first of all, the number one international issue right now is the question of war with Iran. The whole world is very, very closely following the situation because the United States government and the Israeli government each has announced that if Iran pursues its nuclear program, the United States will not permit it. It will attack, or it will let Israel attack. And Iran is going ahead with a program that they say is a peaceful one, but nonetheless a nuclear program. The United States has said that's unacceptable. This is a very, very grave situation. The number one, the most important alliance that the United States has internationally is with Israel. Our politicians and our media have over and over and over again stressed that the U.S. Support for alliance with Israel is the number one feature of our international policy. The problem is that the cost of that alliance is already a very, very high one. It's led us to the war in Iraq. It's already cost the lives of thousands of Americans, and it's cost us billions and tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. It's going to cost us much more. But the cost of the alliance with Israel is going to increase, and the logical extension of that is war with Iran. Now, what are the economic consequences of that for America? Yes, it will be very bad, but the situation in our country is already so economically bad that even without a war with Iran, it's going to be very bad in the next 5 years. That's my prediction. The Comptroller of the United States just recently issued a report in which he stressed that the economic situation of this country is unsustainable. Our debt is completely out of control. We just do not have the money to pay. The United States is like someone who's been living on credit cards for a long time. The credit card, the credit is held overwhelmingly by Asians in Japan, Taiwan, China, Singapore, and so forth. But the day of reckoning is going to come in this. And the ability of our country to pay out, to sustain itself economically, is going to be very severely a challenge when the baby boomers all start retiring and start wanting to collect on their Social Security, but we just don't have the money for that. So even apart from the war with Iran, economically, the situation is just not sustainable. And this was confirmed just the other week in a report by the Comptroller of the United States. Now, internationally, war with Iran would be a catastrophe for the United States. And Americans have been protected over much of our history of the consequences of our international policy to our country, because America is a very large country with big oceans, and so we do not have the experience of other countries which have lost wars, which have been occupied. We look at war. Americans tend to look at war as something that happens way over there, somewhere else. We tend to look in this country at war as a kind of game, like a football game. That's why Americans like to talk about winning. They have this idea that war is something like a game you play, you win, and then you come home and everything goes back to normal. But wars, especially in this era, are not like that anymore.
We will be back with Mark Weber, the Executive Director of the Institute for Historical Review, and Mark Dankoff's America returns live from San Antonio, Texas on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Stay tuned. Mark Dankoff's America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Mark Weber, the Executive Director of the Institute for Historical Review. Mark, getting back to what we were talking about before the break, in a worst-case scenario, if the United States and or Israel attacks Iran, with all of the political, diplomatic, economic, and cultural ramifications of this, and it proves to be a catastrophe, which both you and I clearly think it would be, do you think that the American people will connect the dots between the neoconservative ideologues who have promoted this sort of thing and the Israeli lobby, and that if they make the connections where those dots are concerned, that the backlash against the leadership of the United States for having failed its people in this regard would ultimately be extended to the Jewish establishment in this country?
That's very difficult to say, I think, Mark, because it's Americans still, in spite of all the problems, have a difficult time looking and thinking alternatively from the way we've been doing things for the last 40, 50, 60 years. The American public is used to a choice between the Democrat and Republican political leaders. Both parties are completely beholden to the powers that be. That is, both political parties are committed to supporting Israeli Zionist interests against the interests of our people. Very, very few voices within the establishment and within the media will speak out against them. The problem is that the American public, even when they understand the situation, are very reluctant to really vote for or support a real alternative to our system. You know, it's illustrated, well, millions of Americans still think that, well, they think that the answer to our problems is to hold on more tightly to our Constitution, for example. And they are easily swayed by political leaders who talk about patriotism and who wave the flag and so forth. But the country is no longer a republic in the way that those people like to think it is. It's an empire. And the Constitution has long since to be used for in the way that our founding fathers wanted. It's very difficult to see or to imagine how there's going to be a real change and shift in attitude among the American until there's a really major crisis. It's just difficult to predict the answer to your question.
Yeah, and you know, to me, as I look at this, this is certainly what I believe on the subject. And for me, the whole question is going to be whether or not the kind of crisis that we envision could take place, particularly as it pertains to this brewing war with Iran. You have to wonder whether or not the crisis would result in a search to recast this country as it once was, or whether the crisis would simply destroy any semblance of a chance that the United States could once again be reconstituted as a republic. That,
yeah.
That is the essential question, and of course I don't have the answer.
Yeah, you know, apart even from the situation in Iran, an issue much closer to the heart of American public is the issue of immigration. Overwhelmingly, the public wants a cutback, a curtailment of immigration to this country, especially illegal immigration. Poll after poll, referendum after referendum has shown a very, very strong public feeling on this issue. And yet, our political leaders and our courts and our media simply ignore the will of the American people. The American people feel very strongly about this, but there's no expression of it, essentially no expression of it in our political system and our media. That's something that is a public more than any other issue, one of the reasons why there's so little confidence in our system. In California, well, in many states, people vote for laws saying we don't want public funds going to illegal aliens. And the courts and the political leaders just say, screw you, we're going to do what I want, we don't care what the public thinks. Well, that's not an expression of the will of the people anymore. And on that issue alone, there's this immense distrust of our political system. Now, the international situation is harder for many Americans to grasp because it is in a foreign country. But the issue of illegal immigration is one that everyone can see and has already been manifest in polls and in political ways in a way that the international situation is not.
Yes, and I remember listening to Pat Buchanan some time ago, where he was pointing out that in 1992, when he was running for president in the Republican primaries against George Herbert Walker Bush, there were thought to be somewhere between 2 and 3 illegal immigrants in the United States. And, of course, Buchanan was making illegal immigration one of his key points against Bush in 1992, the senior Bush. And yet here we are 14 or 15 years later, and depending on whose figures one believes, we have somewhere between 8 and 15 or as many as 20 million illegals in this country. And there's talk, of course, serious talk on Capitol Hill that McCain and Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, may be ultimately successful in getting an immigration bill passed in this country that would involve amnesty for all of those illegals. And I've argued consistently that if there's a blanket amnesty given to all the illegals that are currently in this country, the ball game is over. At that juncture, it would seem to me that we would be well on our way toward third world status at that point.
Well, that's very, a very good point, yeah. But who's worse, McCain or Kennedy or any of these other people that want to put into law an amnesty, or the present leadership of this country, the administration of George W. Bush, which simply ignores the law, which simply doesn't enforce the law. A country that doesn't enforce its law is hardly a country to be taken seriously anymore. And we just simply don't enforce our laws. Another point here is that one of the characteristics of an empire is that it doesn't have real borders. Everybody with it, there are no borders within an empire. And that's increasingly true of this country. In fact, now the military is talking about introducing automatic citizenship for foreigners who volunteer for the American military because they don't want to introduce the draft. They've institutionalized a mercenary army in this country, And a logical extension of that is to open the U.S. military to people from everywhere in the world if they qualify. And as part of that, they become American citizens. That's not a country, a military that represents America anymore. It's simply a military force to further the interests of those people who hold power in this country.
Yeah, and it seems to me at that juncture, quite clearly, the American military would become nothing more than a foreign janissary force for all kinds of globalist economic and political interests.
Yes.
Yes. Well, listen, let's turn to the whole issue then of the Holocaust and Holocaust revisionism. I have followed a little bit some of the controversy that surrounds the Zundel and David Irving cases. Discuss, if you would, a little bit your understanding of what did happen in Nazi Germany during World War II with this whole business of the Holocaust. And then I would like to move from that into a discussion of the way in which a certain type of Holocaust dogmatic orthodoxy has become so precious to so many people in the Western world since World War II, and then move from that, if you would, to a discussion of what the implications are for free speech as those who do not agree with this particular brand of Holocaust orthodoxy are subsequently subjected to harassment and in some cases illegitimate prosecutions and even incarcerations.
Well, maybe to go to your last point first, just last
sure.
week, David Irving was released from prison in Austria. This was a surprise. It was an international news story. It's been in newspapers all around the country. David Irving, in February, he's a prominent British historian, much vilified in the media, was sentenced to 3 years in prison last February for remarks he had made 16 years earlier to some meetings in Austria. In these meetings, he referred to the Holocaust as a myth, I think. But it doesn't really matter. He made remarks which run counter to the prevailing orthodoxy on this issue. And for those remarks made 16 years earlier, he was sentenced by a court in Austria to 3 years in prison. Now, just the other week, the court decided to reduce that and to let him out on probation for the remainder of his sentence, and he flew back to England, and he's been since trying to reestablish his life in Britain. But Irving is just one of three prominent individuals in Europe who have been in prison for dissident views, a peaceful expression of dissident views on this Holocaust issue. It's the only issue for which people are and have been punished, put into jail, fined, forced into exile for questioning. And David Irving is the most prominent of these people. Now, what this does, of course, is underscore the hypocrisy of governments that claim to be in favor of free speech and free expression, but which at the same time imprison people if they express dissident views on this one chapter of history. You can say all sorts of things in public, but if you dispute what has become a kind of icon or quasi-religious icon in our society, the Holocaust, that can put you in jail in most of the countries or many of the countries of Europe. Now, it's an issue for all of us because it underscores a couple of things. First of all, it shows the tremendous double standard that exists in our society. That is, you can make remarks which are offensive to Christians or to Muslims, but remarks that are considered offensive to Jews in our society and are slapped down and in some cases, as I just mentioned, punished with jail, with imprisonment. There's a tremendous double standard on this thing that is an expression of the tremendous Jewish Zionist power in our society and its ability to enforce that power even in our cultural life. That's one thing. Another point is that is how the media in our society treats all of this. We're told over and over about the importance of freedom, and we're even willing to, our government will kill people, send Americans into battle to bring so-called freedom to Iraq, but it will not defend one of these basic freedoms. It doesn't protest when people like David Irving and Ernst Zundel and so forth are put into prison. Ernst Zundel is currently undergoing a trial in Germany right now. He's now celebrating or marking his third Christmas in prison. He's not been convicted of anything. He was held for more than a year in Canadian detention, and now he's been held for a year in German prison as his trial grinds on, also for his dissident views on the Holocaust issue. Now, he raised this larger question of the Holocaust. Now, it's unquestionable that the Jews in Europe during World War II suffered. But there's a great deal about the Holocaust story that has changed over the years, but it's presented in our society as a kind of religious thing that can't be challenged. And it's an issue that should be dealt with by historians and not by courts.
Yes. And do you find, as you look at the Zundel case and the David Irving case, that with all of the talk about pending hate crimes legislation in the United States that could conceivably, and many people believe, will be modeled after what we've seen in Britain and Canada and Australia and elsewhere, do you think that this sort of thing will come to pass in the U.S. in a way that will specifically target people for hate crimes, the commission of hate crimes, who speak out on this issue? And do you see the possibility that people like yourself and Michael Collins Piper and some of the people that write for American Free Press and others who have not affirmed the orthodoxy on this issue of either the Holocaust or the role of the Israeli lobby in American political life will at some point be subjected potentially to the same kinds of strictures that have happened to Zundel and to David Irving?
Well, it might surprise some people, but I think this is unlikely. I think that the high point of these kinds of laws, certainly these Holocaust denial laws in Europe, have been reached. There is a internationally very strong condemnation of these laws. The only voices speaking out for these laws publicly, for these laws punishing people for dissident views on the Holocaust, have been the Simon Wiesenthal Center, the Anti-Defamation League, Israel, the usual Jewish and Zionist mouthpieces. But around the world, scholars, newspapers, everyone widely has condemned these laws as a blatant, obvious, hypocritical violation of a basic issue of basic free speech matter. Now, it's very difficult to see these laws being introduced in this country because at the same time that the government tries to crack down, things just don't work in America as well as they could. Before somebody like you or I would be put in jail, they would have to jail an awful lot of people. There are many, many voices in this country speaking out against the establishment, and the voices are more prominent and they're louder. And a good example of that is the recent book even by Jimmy Carter, former President Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter is now being denounced as an anti-Semite by the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. That's ridiculous. It's an absurdity. But as some people have put it, anti-Semitism, an anti-Semite is no longer someone who hates Jews, it's someone whom Jews hate. And if Jimmy Carter is an anti-Semite, well, then the whole world practically is anti-Semitic, because what Jimmy Carter has written in his new book about the Israel-Palestine situation is a worldwide consensus. But there are more and more voices speaking out against this power and its grip on our society, and it's very difficult to see how they would crack down. I find it very hard to imagine that very many people would be put in jail, and that Americans would put up that this thing could be, that the establishment get away with it. There's increasingly just a breakdown in our society and its ability to enforce its own laws. And the disaster in Iraq is an expression of just how increasingly incompetent our system is to enforce its will.
Well, you know, thinking of these absolutely ludicrous attempts on the part of the Wiesenthal Center and the ADL to characterize Jimmy Carter as an anti-Semite, you know, that is the sort of thing, of course, as you point out, that's inherently ludicrous. Whatever one thinks of Carter one way or the other, that's clearly a ludicrous charge. Do you think that this is indicative? We'll get to this question when we come back from the commercial break, but I wanted to ask you if you thought this was indicative of a level of desperation that indicates that maybe these guys are losing. We will be back with Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review when Mark Dankos America returns live on the Republic Broadcasting Network from San Antonio, Texas. Stay tuned. Mark Dankos America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Mark Weber, the Executive Director of the Institute for Historical Review. Just wanted to warn Mark and our listeners that we have in these next 10 minutes or so some frequent commercial breaks, and then there will be a longer period of time for some more extended conversation once more. Note a couple of things related to the Republic Broadcasting Network. You can support us by contacting us online at rbnlive.com or giving us a call at 1-800-724-2719. That's 1-800-724-2719. You can send your gifts to Republic Broadcasting Network at either of those contact points. You can also have new Republic Broadcasting Network T-shirts, which are available at both rbnlive.com as well as notyranny.com, or again by calling the office at 1-800-724-2719. You can also have Aaron Russo's new DVD, America, Freedom to Fascism, by contacting RBN again at rbnlive.com or giving us a call at 1-800-724-2719. That DVD can be yours for $19.95 plus $4.95 shipping and handling. We also have our call-in number today for questions for Mark Weber. That's at 1-800-313-9443. David in California, you're on the line for Mark Weber. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, how are you? I am kind of stuck on this one. I as a historian, really see that throughout history, centuries, eons, people have tried to essentially fraud the public with financial currency speculation. And so when the public finally, when the little guy finally makes a little bit of money, the fat cats come along and scrape the cream off the top, and in doing that, it crushes whole towns and villages and countries. So, you know, we've seen many, many, many examples of this, and obviously killing the Jews in Europe had a lot to do with the Jews were making a certain amount of money, and the thieves of the day were interested in stealing it. So the idea of whether that's happening in Iraq right now, or whether that's happening in Africa right now, or whether that's happening in California right now is always how you make sure that you don't forget history. So when I was listening to your conversation there, I'm reminded that Hitler came to power with a lot of kind of mom and apple pie issues. It had to do with many of his mom and apple pie issues had to do with that the little guy was being cheated, and that the only way to get even was to kill everybody that was the enemy. Well, in this case, Hitler was in bed with the enemy, and he pointed to the wrong people. So I'm very interested in this because the idea that, say, for example, George Bush is doing the same thing right now, and it seems like this whole revisionism issue is just trying to steer the youth of the world into the wrong direction.
David, hold on. We'll run this by Mark Weber when we come back from the break. This is Mark Dankos America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Stay tuned. David in California, I'm sorry we had to break away for a second, but go ahead, sir.
Yeah, well, maybe I did a long-winded version of it, but it sounded like your guest is trying to blame the wrong people. Obviously, the fat cats are the ones that are setting the currency rates, the exchange rates. They're the ones that are making sure that the little guy is always getting the short end of the stick, and they're doing it through money manipulation. So, for example, you know, we, the little guy, are never told what it really costs to survive anymore. We're told that we're supposed to be silent, independent types, who always stay quiet. Well, that flies in the face of 1776, when you were supposed to open up your mouth and you were supposed to join with your neighbors in united you stand, divided you fall. So, you know, the fat cats of the day want us to be loners, you know, the silent type loners who never make any noise and will always get suckered. And this idea of being divided you stand, united you fall is the scam that they're trying to push. And so when I hear the so-called experts telling me that I'm supposed to believe that up is down and down is up, you know, it's I'm wondering why your guest wants me to go on the wrong path.
Well, sir, I don't want you to go on the wrong path. One of the big issues that Mark and I have been talking about on this show is the Iraq war. Nothing right now is draining our national wealth more than this Iraq war. It's cost us hundreds of billions of dollars. The estimates go up to $1 trillion or whatever. It's cost us 3,000 American lives. That's irreplaceable, of course, far beyond money. And if you're concerned about the great issues of our time, the Iraq war is the number one issue internationally in our in the world today and for Americans. Now, the question is, how did that war come about? It came about, I think the evidence is absolutely overwhelming, to promote Israeli and Zionist interests. And the fat cats, actually, didn't want the war. They were, I mean, major oil companies, American Corporation, didn't want this war. The war was pushed by those whose primary loyalty and primary interest were for Israel and for Zionist interests. Now, that's one of the issues we were talking about. If you don't think that that's true, you should investigate it, look into it, and I think you'll find on our website, IHR.org, and on many other websites, that the evidence is simply overwhelming that the main impetus, the main motive behind the Iraq war, and now the main motive behind a war with Iran, is to secure and to promote Israeli and Zionist interests. Now, certainly, the big boys want to increase their wealth at the expense of other people. But we were talking and in this program, and of course it's the international issue, this issue of war and peace in the world today, which is a paramount issue for all of us.
Okay, well, you know, the only thing I would agree with you on is the expression Zionist. Because to me, it's very interesting. The more you study Judaism, the more you realize that that the most religious or orthodox of the Jews don't even believe in Israel as a nation. They believe that God owns the whole world and that there's not a single dot on the planet that is so chosen or that is so so sacrosanct. They think that everything God owns is sacrosanct, and that to pretend that there's a single dot on the earth like Israel is an insult to God. So the Zionists are actually con men who are trying to get a military foothold in that area and control the oil. So to pretend that the Zionists are Jewish is pretty much a stretch. They're organized crime, and they're different than crude Jews who believe in the Ten Commandments.
Mark, now that we're back from the break, I was going to say your website has consistently distinguished between Zionists and Orthodox Jews, like in this Naturae Carta group, who don't support Zionism and who don't support the initiatives of the New World Order. Is that correct?
Well, that's true. There is a small minority of Jews, the most prominent of which is represented in this group called the Naturae Carta. They're Orthodox Jews, and they believe that a Jewish state should not be established before the return of the Messiah. But they represent a very small minority. Every major important Jewish organization in this country, and the Defamation League, Simon Wiesenthal Center, and so forth, are ardent supporters of Israel. The most important lobby group in the United States in Washington is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is very, very strongly supported, of course, by Jewish money, Jewish interest in this country. It's the main pillar to secure a pro-Israel Congress. More than a year ago, I attended an AIPAC meeting here in California. It was held at a synagogue. The AIPAC speakers at the meeting emphasized that they had the support in this initiative of every synagogue, whether it was conservative, reform, or orthodox, in Orange County, where we're located and where we live. the there's not a single in our society, if politicians are not supportive of Israel, just abjectly supportive of Israel, they're destroyed in political life. And the political leadership of both the Democratic and Republican parties are absolutely, abjectly supportive of Israel and its interests, largely due to the important role that Jews play in our society politically and culturally. It's been estimated by authoritatively that something like 60% of the money that went to the Democratic Party in recent presidential elections came from Jews, and something like 40% to the Republican Party came from Jews. Jews hold in our society tremendously disproportionate power and influence. And anyone who fails to grasp that fact is just ignoring a central fact, a central feature of American political life.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's indisputable, and as you cite here, it's certainly proven by quantitative data. If you were to analyze the Political Action Committee money and analyze the voting powers or the voting trends of these various people in the Republican and Democratic parties, I simply think that this can be proven beyond a reasonable shadow of a doubt. Now, in terms of IPAC, the espionage case that involved Rosen and Weissman of IPAC and their involvement with getting Larry Franklin, who was an Iran expert at the National Security Council, to turn over information to these IPAC leaders that was presumably passed on to Israel, I think we can assume. That case has not gotten any publicity that I can see in recent times. Why is that, and what is the status of that case now?
Well, I know a lot of people have seized upon the Larry Franklin case, the AIPAC thing, as in the hopes that this would sort of expose AIPAC power. But the U.S. government has prosecuted this case not because they want to harm AIPAC, but because they don't like people in the U.S. government passing documents of any kind outside of the normal channels. You know, the Israeli ambassador even joked that he doesn't need anybody passing information. He can just get it straight from the White House or from people directly. The prosecution of the case has been solely based on just keeping people from acting outside of channels. And the reason we don't hear much about the case is that no one in Washington wants to implicate AIPAC as an organization in all of this, and AIPAC's power is just undeterred as a result of all of this. That's the reason I think that the thing has not gotten much attention in our media.
Yes, and certainly there was some insistence after this latest exposé came out that AIPAC should be required to register as a foreign lobby. It seems that went absolutely nowhere and has been buried by a conspiracy of silence. So I think we can safely assume that the existence of this organization and its effectiveness in subverting American domestic and foreign policy is likely to continue unabated.
Right,
Roger,
exactly. Yeah.
Yes. Roger in Pennsylvania, you're on the line for Mark Weber. Go ahead, sir.
Following off the previous caller, and I almost wish I had a chance to follow up on this yesterday, was that it is always a mistake in Christian theology to subject it to Jewish interpretations, and that could apply, including Orthodox Jewish interpretations of that Zionist state. So it wouldn't logically follow. If it would do so, it would be, one might say, merely incidentally. Now, that having been said, one could, in this dispensational mold, say, allow a formula that in God's prevenient will, he would create a Jewish state, say, and it could even have less than, say, 5% blood Jews in it, etc. But that still would beg the question of it would have a low view of the sovereignty of God in that same mold, that somehow could only be done with Christian American blood to be the secular salvation of that Jewish state.
Well, I don't know. I don't understand your question, sir. I don't know how to.
Well, it's kind of a combined. You see what I mean. Those who would argue that position, and therefore also require that God requires America to pull off that deliverance of this Zionist state?
Well, I just don't have any comments, sir. I don't know how to respond.
Well, I think, Roger, you know, one thing that clearly comes up in this again and time and again when this whole subject of Zionism emerges is the whole way in which the dispensational premillennial understanding of Bible prophecy, which is the majority view of the Christian religious right in the United States, you know, continues to cement its own relationship with the Zionist state of Israel. I think that's clear. I think it's also clear that, and I think Mark Weber certainly would agree with this, that this is another instance of where a constituency, in this case the Christian religious right in the United States, finds itself an absolute paradox in that because of the dispensational understanding of the Bible, it feels compelled to support the Zionist state of Israel. At the same time, that the major Jewish constituencies in the United States that support the Zionist state of Israel have a cultural and political agenda that, properly understood, is absolutely anathema to the Christian religious right. Mark Glenn talked about this a little bit yesterday, the whole notion that here you have a circumstance where people like John Hagee and Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and D. James Kennedy and Dobson and others seem to be very solidly supportive of the broad parameters of a Zionist-oriented foreign policy, and never talk about the fact that whether you're looking at the abortion industry, the pornography industry, and the movement toward the support of the gay rights agenda and so forth, that all of this has a disproportionate amount of Jewish support and Jewish logistical support and Jewish financing for it. So the paradoxes in this absolutely never cease to amaze the objective observer. And going back again a generation or so in American politics, I think this quite clearly is why you had a Christian right, Republican establishment right figure like Jesse Helms on the one hand, the former U.S. Senator from North Carolina, being so supportive of the state of Israel. And then you could turn around and have someone as far to the left as Bella Abzug, the former congresswoman from New York, supporting the same thing. So the paradoxes never cease, it seems to me. And I think quite clearly, if we continue in this present vein of supporting wars on behalf of Israel, utilizing the American military on a proxy basis for this, that those conflicts and paradoxes and antitheses, I think, will only get worse in the days ahead. Tom in California, you're on the line for Mark Weber. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, yeah, I used to be a member of the Institute for Historical Review 20 years ago, and I remember they had a firebombing of the Institute. It was in La Costa Mesa, California, or something. I think it was the Israeli Mossad that came in and they used like flamethrowers or something, and they just destroyed all the archives of the manuscripts that the various authors had submitted to the Institute for publication. And then this had been after that they had threatened destruction of the Institute many times, death threats and so on. And I was really upset about the Institute that they allowed the attack to occur. They know they would just left the place undefended during the weekend, and then the whole place was firebombed and completely destroyed. And I said, I should just quit. These people are no good, this Institute for Historic Review. And then I kept paying my dues another year, and then they had a $50,000 amount of money in a trust, in a bank account that said the Jews, and if they want this money, they have to prove, submit evidence according to the United States court system requirements.
Stay on the line. I'm coming to another commercial break. I'll let you continue when we come back. This is Mark Dankos, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Back with Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review. When we return, stay tuned. Tom in California, sorry we had to go to a break, but go ahead with the rest of your question or comment, Tom.
I was a member of the Institute 20 years ago, and then after they firebombed, the Jews firebombed the Institute, I was really, you know, upset. I was going to quit. And then they had a $50,000 reward telling the Jews, if you want this money, you have to prove the Germans operated death camps, not concentration camps, death camps. The evidence has to be according to the, it has to meet the standards of the United States of America court system. Well, then a Jewish judge in Los Angeles, he just takes a Jewish man and he says, well, we are not going to argue about whether or not the Germans operated death camps or concentration camps. We're just going to say that they operated death camps, and we're going to take this $50,000 away from the Institute. And so the Institute loses 50 grand to these rotten Jews in Los Angeles. And then they're sitting there begging. They send these form letters begging for more money. And I thought, oh, these people, this Institute of Historic Review, this is crazy.
Well,
and I quit my support of the Institute, and I haven't been a member since. It was just so disgusting about how the Institute handled the resources that they had under their own management. It's just amazing that they were that bad, you know.
Well, sir, I'll address the issues you raised. First of all, about the reward of the $50,000. That was done years before I began working here. I would not have handled a situation like that. I think it was not handled well, but I had nothing to do with the decision at the time. I became director of the Institute in 1995, some years after all of that. As I say, I wouldn't have handled it like that, but the situation was such that there's not much the IHR could have done under the circumstances because of the ruling of the court. But more importantly, you talked about the 1984 firebombing of the IHR's offices. That was a big blow. The fact is, it's almost impossible to prevent such a thing. There was an alarm system at the office, at that time it was in Torrance, California. The firebombing took place on July 4th, of all things. Now, we now know that the people who carried it out were members, activists of the Jewish Defense League. It's a Zionist activist organization, and it was carried out specifically by two individuals, Irv Rubin, who's now dead, and Earl Krugel, who's also dead. Irv Rubin later was arrested for planning the firebombing of a mosque in Los Angeles and of a U.S. congressman's office, and he apparently committed suicide in prison. But we now have the investigation report by the police and the fire department at the time that shows that it was the JDL, and specifically Irv Rubin and Earl Krugel, carried out the firebombing. I don't think anything could have been done to really prevent it. If somebody is determined to assassinate or kill someone or blow up something, there's very little that can be done to prevent that. Luckily or happily, since 1985, there have not been any attacks against our office. I think part of the reason for that is that for groups like the JDL, terrorist groups like that, the list of their enemies has gotten immensely larger than it was in 1984. In 1984, the IHR was special, unique almost. But now, for groups like that, their list of enemies is now so large, so extensive, they hardly know where to begin, and we're just one of many groups that they would like to eliminate. But around the world, there's just greater awareness of the kinds of issues that the IHR has raised over the years, much greater awareness than there was back in the 1980s. And it's manifest during this past year by several things. As I mentioned, the book by Jimmy Carter, in which he talked about in his book about the intimidating power that exists in our country that prevents any open debate on this issue. Earlier this year also, two prominent professors, Stephen Walt and John Mersheimer, two prominent professors, one at the University of Chicago University and the other at Harvard University, issued a very important paper on the Israel lobby, which detailed very well the intimidating and powerful impact of this lobby in our society. And this has also contributed, along with shows like this one and many other people, about the dangerous and immense power that this lobby has in our society. Now, I'm sorry that you were discouraged by your support for the IHR, but I think if you click on our website, you'll find a lot there, ihr.org, that will encourage you and that you'll like. And we've been doing a great deal of very important work in the last several years and reaching a lot of people. And I ask you to return.
Would you agree that the Germans never did operate death camps? They operated concentration camps, and that the whole death camp thing is just a big lie? Would you agree with that statement or not?
Well,
disagree with it or not? Well, I don't know why you have to go into a huge elaboration, you know? Do you agree that the Germans operated concentration camps or death camps? I mean, you know, what is your opinion? I think they operated concentration camps, not death camps.
It's hard to, well, I guess we have to take a break. I'll answer that when I come back.
Yes, we are at another commercial break. We'll hold Mark Weber's answer until we come back on Mark Dankoff's America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. And I wanted to ask Mark a little bit more about Jimmy Carter and Benjamin Netanyahu and Holocaust dogma and Iran. Stay tuned. We're back. This is Mark Dankoff's America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Mark Weber, the Executive Director of the Institute for Historical Review, which you can find at www.ihr.org. And among many other things there, one can sign up for their free news briefings, which can arrive in your respective mailboxes online on the World Wide Web, if that sort of thing interests you. I also wanted to mention before we get back to Mark Weber that I'm going to have some interesting folks on next week after the new year has been ushered in. Frosty Wooldridge, my old friend at BATR Columnist Guild, who is a recognized international expert in the area of illegal immigration, is going to come on Tuesday. At some point next week, I'm going to have Scott Stevens on the show from Weather Wars to talk about the whole issue of chemtrails from a very fascinating perspective. And then I have written Michael Collins Piper a note that I would like to have him on at some point to discuss his most recent travels to Iran. Mark Glenn and I were talking about this yesterday. Mark Glenn of Crescent and Cross was telling me that Michael Collins Piper had just gotten back from another trip to Iran. And since I have not been in Iran for 30 years, I, of course, lived over there when my parents were stationed there back in the days of the Pahlavi regime. A lot has transpired, I'm sure, in three decades, and I would like to have a first-hand report from a reliable eyewitness and journalist in regard to his perceptions of the country of Iran and what he feels is going on over there and what he sees of the future relationship between the United States and Iran. So if Michael Collins Piper can clear his schedule and come on the show in the next week or two, I would really appreciate it, because I, like everyone else, would be sitting at the feet of the master listening to his perceptions of what that present circumstance is like in Iran, what's happening there politically and culturally and otherwise. We're back with Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review. Mark, where did we leave off?
Well, we left off about the Holocaust. The short answer to the man's question is the Holocaust story is exaggerated. Many Holocaust claims are untrue or exaggerated, but the Holocaust story plays in our society a kind of quasi-religious role. The 6 million figure that we hear over and over is an exaggeration. Now, if those who want to know more about this issue should check on the IHR website, and they can find much more in detail about this. But I'm less concerned about whether the number of Jews who died or were killed in World War II was 1 million or 6 million or 10 million than I am about the consequences of the Holocaust story, the role the Holocaust story plays in our society today. It plays this very important role as a way of encouraging support for Israel and for Jewish interests. It has this semi-official or semi-religious, even official status in our society, but it's a focus on Jewish suffering to the exclusion, or certainly overshadowing, the suffering of others. Jewish death and suffering does not deserve to be memorialized more than death and suffering of other people. And there's a huge disproportionality in the focus on Jewish suffering and death during World War II, overshadowing that of other people. You know, Americans are expected and trained to know almost reflexively that Hitler killed 6 million Jews. Now, as I said, that's an exaggeration. But Americans have, even educated Americans, have no idea how many Russians, Chinese, Poles, Germans, or even Americans lost their lives in World War II. The Holocaust plays this a very important role in our society as an expression of Jewish Zionist power in our society. And you'll find much more about that on our website, and that's what I would refer the caller and to other people who are interested in that to check out.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things to me in regard to this whole business of this Holocaust dogma and orthodoxy is surely it cannot be an accident that the last couple of times I have heard Benjamin Netanyahu speak on this whole question of Iran, he keeps invoking this Holocaust imagery as a means of arguing that the West and Israel need to attack Iran militarily. The other thing, of course, that comes up in this regard was Tehran's recent sponsorship of this seminar conference where the Holocaust was the main topic of conversation. I have not yet had a chance to read any of the papers that were presented at that conference, Mark. Maybe you've had a chance to do that. But
yeah, I've read four or five of the papers. I've tried to follow it closely. One of the most remarkable features of the conference is how misreported, how inaccurately reported it was in the Western media. It was billed and presented in the American media as a conference of Holocaust deniers. That's just ridiculous. Anyone who paid attention closely to what actually happened at the conference can see that that's not true. But that was the focus of the media presentation there. In fact, many of the papers were quite good. I mean, very, very well done. There was no one there. None of the speakers, quote, denied the Holocaust. In fact, even the use of the term Holocaust denial is a loaded one. It's a false way of presenting the thing because it implies that those people who dispute the Orthodox Holocaust story or aspects of it are somehow deliberately lying. They're in denial, so to speak. Well, that's just ridiculous. The Holocaust story should be looked at and be allowed to be looked at with the same objectivity that we look at other chapters of history. And the way in which the American media presents this thing is an expression of just how uniquely the Holocaust or the suffering of Jews is presented in our society as opposed to that of any other people.
Yeah, and for example, the clear conspiracy of silence pertaining to this whole issue of Armenians at the hands of Turks during and after the First World War, and then, of course, all of the people killed by Stalin in his forced agricultural collectivization policies in the Ukraine. Many times the number of people, I understand, that were killed, Jewish people that were killed at the hands of Hitler in World War II, and yet this is conveniently never discussed in the mainstream American press.
We're expected in America to have a special reverence for attention to the Jewish death and suffering in the way that we aren't of other people. I mean, it's most obvious in our presentation of the Middle East. When Jews die, or when Israelis die in bombing or whatever in Israel, there's a huge emphasis on that in the media. And you get the impression that Israelis are dying at a larger rate than Palestinians, when exactly the opposite is the truth. Far more Palestinians have been killed by Israelis than vice versa, than Israelis have been killed by Palestinians. But the operating assumption of the American media and of our political leaders is that we automatically, reflexively, should have great sympathy and understanding for Israel and its position and the suffering and the position of Jews. Well, this is we do this even to the extent of our own interest and our own perspective on the whole thing. And this is manifest in our media and our. We have a huge museum in Washington, D.C., the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, operated by a U.S. government agency. It's a U.S. government institution. We have no comparable museum memorializing the deaths or sufferings of any other group of people, even though it supposedly memorializes non-Americans victimized by non-Americans. But we have no similar monument or museum or any other institutions memorializing any other people.
Yes. Well, Mark, to what extent do you think, and I'm using myself as an example here, I go back to years ago when I was in college and I was a young Turk activist in the Reagan wing of the Republican Party back in the mid-70s when I did volunteer work for Ronald Reagan in 1976 while I was a college student. And Reagan was running against Gerald Ford in the Indiana State Republican primary in May of 1976. At that time, I was reading National Review and Human Events predominantly, and pretty much accepting the party line that you see in both of the major political parties in the United States on Israel and on Zionism. Well, here we are all these many years later, and of course, because of this internet age, I have access to your website. I have access to Mark Glenn's Crescent and Cross website. I have access to Hassan El-Najjar's website at aljazeera.info. And all of a sudden, a guy like me is seeing the kinds of pictures of atrocities that are routinely taking place in Gaza and the West Bank, and is seeing a whole different picture, pictorially and in word analysis, a completely different perspective on this situation in Palestine than I was ever led to believe was the case. Now, if I have begun a major reassessment in the last 10 or 15 years of my life in all of this, can we presume that there are other people out there in the general American populace that are exposed to some of this information in this internet age who are saying, wait a minute, we've been hoodwinked in this. We not only believe that we should not be supporting this, we're sure as HELL not going to be supporting the idea of sending our men and women into harm's way in order to support what's going on in Gaza and elsewhere.
Yeah, well put, Mark. I mean, I went through a similar kind of transformation in my life. When I was young, my view of the Middle East was shaped by the media and motion pictures such as Exodus, which was this huge, big Hollywood presentation, very pro-Israel, very pro-Zionist, and it affected my outlook. And it was only later that I learned that the presentation of the Middle East situation, of the Israel-Palestine situation that I'd gotten from our media, from our political leaders, and from our motion pictures, is a cartoon one. It's essentially a distortion of the reality. And the awakening or the maturing that you went through, that I went through, is one that many, many, many people in our country and around the world have gone through. And it's, of course, one of the conclusions we derive from all of that is an awareness of just how much we have been misled in our educational system and by our government on this issue, and with it, along with that, many other issues as well. But certainly an understanding of the realities of the Middle East situation is absolutely crucial, because it's the center point of conflict and strife in the world today, and as most obviously manifest right now in the terrible situation in Iraq. Unless Americans, and until Americans can understand that, we're going to have many, many more problems like the Iraq War, but also the 9/11 attack, until we understand and come to grips with this issue.
At the risk of a diversion from what I was getting ready to ask you in regard to your own autobiography, do you think that this 9/11 attack was an inside job?
No, I don't. I think that many of those people who emphasize or talk about it as an inside job are people who want to detach the 9/11 terror attack from the larger world context. The fact is that millions of people so hate our government for its policies and so hate this country that they're willing to kill themselves to strike back at the United States. Now, even apart from the 9/11 attack, this fury, this anger, this rage has been manifest in many other ways in the Middle East and here in our country. Remember, another group tried to blow up the World Trade Center several years before the 9/11 attack in 2001. And Americans, many of those people who look at this thing, do so without any understanding of the larger context. Unfortunately, I think there will be more tragedies, more terrorist attacks like that until we come to grips with this, with the larger issue. The United States is the only country that guarantees and supports with military power and huge amounts of financial aid the state of Israel, and supports policies that are contrary not only to our stated principles but also to our interests. And we have made enemies of many people around the world. Increasingly, the world is divided into a U.S.-Israel alliance on the one hand, and increasingly the whole rest of the world on the other, because the rest of the world does not have an interest in the wars and the conflict and the strife, which are an inevitable part of our alliance with Israel and of Israeli policy.
To what extent do you think, for example, looking at the American Christian religious right, now, at one level, one could put me in that category from the vantage point that I am an Orthodox Lutheran pastor I have a very orthodox Trinitarian worldview, Christological worldview. I am a traditional theist in the way I look at things, and I accept the Old and the New Testament as God's word. So, and I'm pro-life, and I'm opposed to the gay rights movement and all these other things. So in that regard, most of the secular community in the United States would say, aha, this guy is American Christian right. But I am not, however, a supporter of Zionism. I am not a dispensational premillennialist, so that would automatically have me right at that juncture peripheralized in terms of the mainstream Christian religious right, because it does espouse these things. Do you think that as more Christians are exposed to information regarding some of the political and cultural and social agendas of groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the American Jewish Congress and Hadassah and so forth and so on, that there will eventually become a divide within the American Christian right on the subject of Israel that is much more of an even divide than it would be right now?
Yes, I do. You know, Mark, it's interesting. The only support that Israel has from a substantial number of Christians is in this country. That's due, I think, to special reasons having to do with the history of this country. But around the world, Christians overwhelmingly feel a sense of solidarity with their fellow Christians in the Middle East. American Christians who support Israel are supporting a government that oppresses Christians. The Israeli government does not make any distinction when it carries out its draconian measures against Palestinians, whether the Palestinian is a Christian or a Muslim or has no religion. And the Southern Baptist Convention or people like Pat Roberts and so forth in this country that support Israel do so contrary to the great bulk of opinion about the Middle East that Christians hold around the world. It's only in this country that there's this very odd pro-Zionist Christian movement. I think that the support for Israel among many American Christians, although it's fairly broad, is very thin, that it will change, and it's already changing. The more people know about this situation, the less support there is. It's shocking to me that many of these Americans who support Israel, many American Christians who support Israel, do so without any criticism of the agenda of the major Zionist and Jewish organizations in this country on all the other issues. On every other issue except Israel, these organizations pursue an agenda that is contrary to what American Christians support and want.
Absolutely. And the contrast and the dichotomies and the paradoxes are absolutely staggering. We will be back with Mark Weber, the Executive Director of the Institute for Historical Review, when Mark Dankos America returns live from San Antonio on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Stay tuned. America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our guest in these final minutes of my show today is Mark Weber, the Executive Director of the Institute for Historical Review. You can find his website and the Institute's website at www.ihr.org. That's www.ihr.org. Mark, I am adding my own editorial comment here, and then I'd ask you in the final minutes to kind of summarize where you think things are in the world and what the IHR is going to be up to in coming months and the next year. I was just going to editorialize that I think that this disastrous war in Iraq, which I have been predicting not just for the last few weeks, but for the last 3.5 years was going to be extended into Iran, will eventually result in a large enough catastrophe that it seems to me that when a wide sector of the American public has its livelihood destroyed by a currency devaluation, when there are more and more American young women, men and women, who lose their lives in the expansion of this conflict across a much wider and broader segment of American society, that it may be at that point that we then see the straw that breaks the camel's back and more tough questions being asked as to who led us into this crisis, who led us into this catastrophe, and what kind of accountability should be involved, not only for the political leadership of the United States, but for the vast percentage of these folks who undeniably have been tools of the Israeli lobby.
Well, essentially, I agree with your analysis, Mark. I think that the price we pay, as I mentioned earlier, for our support for Israel and the alliance with Israel is high and it's growing, and unfortunately, it will do nothing but continue in the years ahead. The cost will be many, many tens of thousands of dead in the Middle East, more thousands of Americans killed, many more tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars wasted in this thing, because the state of Israel is essentially an unstable and aberrant state that requires for its survival tremendous transfusions of money and support, and thrives on discord, strife, and war within the Middle East for its existence. That's the reality. And unfortunately, it's going to be a lot more death and suffering, I think, until Americans and wake up to just the disastrous consequences of our alliance with Israel and permitting the supporters of Israel and its policies to have the grip that they do in our political and cultural and social life.
Yeah, and I think as you look at the way in which John Hagee of Cornerstone Church here in San Antonio and others have a totally non-contextual understanding of Genesis 12, verse 3, and utilize that as a 30-second soundbite or less to insist that America will be blessed only as it supports the Zionist state of Israel, the great irony is that we may live to see the day when the exact opposite is proven true, where we could point to the real beginning of the end of the Republic of this country having occurred at a point in time when we threw our lot in with Israel, much to the chagrin of the rest of the world, and with an end game yet unknown, but probably pointing toward war with Iran. I'd like to thank Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review for being on Mark Dankoff's America Today, live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Have a happy new year. See you on Tuesday. God bless.